Ian McEwan on his post-apocalyptic novel What We Can Know, why Patti Smith is still electrifying, and Taylor Sheridan, the hottest showrunner in TV. If you'd like to text us tonight, and our email is arena@rte.ie. Ian McEwan has been at the forefront of British writing for the last 50 years, part of a generation that included his best friends, author Martin Amis and journalist Christopher Hitchens. He's been nominated for the Booker Prize 6 times, winning it for the novel Amsterdam in 1998. His 2002 novel Atonement was turned into a film starring a young Saoirse Ronan. She starred again in the adaptation of his 2007 novel On Chesil Beach. His new 18th novel is What We Can Know, and Ian McEwan joins me now. Perhaps you'd start by telling us when and where we are at the beginning of the novel, Ian.
Beginning of this novel, we're about 100 years into the future. In a much changed world, Britain is a series of islands, an archipelago, and our narrator is a scholar. He's a teacher at a university, and he's interested in a very famous poet, Francis Blundy, who's working in our time. I guess if you had to rank him, he'd be the sort of equivalent of Seamus Heaney. In fact, they're very aware of each other, these two poets. We open with the poet reading a very long sonnet sequence as a gift to his wife on her birthday. And it's a dinner, family and friends. The poet, Francis Blundy, has made sure that there are no copies, other copies of this poem in existence. So it's a very special present, and that poem disappears. And in part, this novel is about a quest to find it. It's a history of our times and how we'll look from the point of view of the future, looking back on us, trying to understand us.
That legendary poem that you talk about, the one that Tom is obsessed with in this book, it's partially inspired by real life, isn't it?
Absolutely. 3 or 4 years ago, I read a poem in the Times Literary Supplement by English poet John Fuller, and it's in the form of what's known as a corona. I mean, most people won't know this form, nothing to do with the pandemic, but actually John Fuller's poem was set a couple, he and his wife, I guess, at the end of a long lockdown. It's spring and they're walking across meadows in the region of Oxford. But the corona form is 15 sonnets. The last line of each sonnet has to be the first line of the next, and most heavily burdened of all, the last sonnet, the 15th, the crown, the corona, has to consist of the first line of all the preceding 14. And these rather ornate demands rather clash beautifully with the relaxed and really insightful and lovely, very moving poem. And I didn't think ever writing a novel that would feature it. But a couple of years later, I was thinking about the future, and this poem suddenly became a vehicle for the scholar's investigations.
In this second immortal dinner, as it comes to be known, which is where the poem is read, it takes place in 2014. It's a year that just happens to be pre-Brexit, pre-President Trump. Why choose that year in particular?
Well, Britain, or maybe I mean more specifically England. No, I think Britain was still in a good mood from the 2012 Olympics. We were not yet thoroughly afflicted or interfered with by social media. I don't think the software had been written for retweeting any idea or any thought or conspiracy theory. To be able to retweet that to, you know, millions, if not thousands of people had not quite been developed. So we were still in a pretty good mood before Brexit. But to be quite honest, I chose it at random and justified it post facto, actually. I didn't want it quite in the present. I wanted it but basically contemporary. The world's fundamentally the world that we know.
I really like the phrase for what you have used that comes afterwards, which is the derangement. So the world of 2119 refers to the derangement. It's one way of describing where we are now and where we're headed. Maybe tell me a little bit about just that phrase and what it means.
Well, I guess we would call it the climate emergency now. This is a term that the scholar explains developed during the 2030s. I chose it because I wanted to suggest a kind of madness in which we are all implicated. It's not only corporations, it's not only reluctant governments, We all, in the first world at least, most of us, enjoy a kind of life that consumes a vast amount of energy. We're all complicit rather, in the burning of fossil fuels. We know we have to stop. We sometimes raise our voices about it. We sometimes march, but still we go on, with flying a couple of thousand miles for a weekend holiday or whatever. So from the viewpoint of 100 years' time, derangement seems like the madness that we are all indulging in, with the consequences that, we largely expect.
Blundy himself, the poet, he's a fascinating character. I mean, the idea that great artists can be very unpleasant, that's not a new one. Blundy himself, though, doesn't really emerge from this story with flying colours, does he?
No, I'm not going to give away the whole story, of course, but at the center of this quest is not only the missing poem, but there emerges a whole set of circumstances leading to a crime in which the poet's wife is also complicit. So to come back to the title, What We Can Know, it's really an investigation into not only what we can know of our past or what we can know about the future and the people in it that we'll never meet and yet to whom we have clearly moral responsibilities, but even the people around us. It's very hard to fundamentally know someone else. And also in there too is someone whose selfhood is draining away in Alzheimer's, crucial to that sort of disintegration of personality when you are afflicted by dementia, is the loss of memory and the importance of memory to identity. So I'm looking at a society as well as individuals and the crucial nature of memory, i.e. history, to the health of those societies.
It is one of the important threads in the book because later on, Vivian is talking to us directly about her first husband, Percy, who has Alzheimer's, and we get a sense of maybe of one of the deeper themes of the book. She says at one stage, Blundy thought we all experienced some version of Percy's dementia. Nearly all of life is forgotten. And it is pretty much, isn't it?
Yes, and I don't know how it is down your way, but history has sort of shrunk in the national curriculum. It is crucial, I think, to a society to have some kind of notion of the past, and especially the recent past, the last 100 or 200 years. We might be sleepwalking yet again into very widespread conflict in Europe, for example. The current turmoil in the United States is a repetition, perhaps, of the 60s, and it would be good if everyone was aware of those consequences. I grew up in the shadow of the Second World War with 90 million dead at my back. And we need to be reminded, we need to keep a hold of what has made us what we are. And part of that is conflict and the habits of war.
What do you make of that? Because we do see it happening every day. If you watch any news broadcast on any particular day, you see people warning about the possible nature of slides into authoritarianism happening all across the world. But there seems to be a generalized consensus of, well, it can't possibly happen again, but it can.
It can, and I think it is. We have across the world a lot of authoritarian governments. Freedom of expression is under a great deal of attack, and that's the freedom that underlies so much else that we treasure in our freedoms. And we see in the USA a kind of leaning towards authoritarianism that we wouldn't have considered conceivable 10 years ago. So, we live in times that remind me of that rather famous Borges story, The Garden of the Forking Paths. We have it in our power to go one way, which could be the path down which we flourish, and we could choose the other. And we stand, I think, at that very apex of the triangle of those forking paths. That's why I think it's of such interest to a historian in 100 years' time. How will we be seen? How will we look? And of course, my researcher, Tom Metcalfe, also envies us because not only are we crazy and deranged, we're clearly capable of extraordinary invention. Biomedicine is flourishing, cosmology is breaking new frontiers, extraordinary developments in mathematics and AI and so on. And, all the other crazinesses, 4 billion people watching a football match or cheese rolling competitions and the energies of, music festivals and street parties. And he lives in a rather moribund, orthodox, conventional world, rather timid, in its intellectual nature. And he envies, you know, for example, a smaller detail, our bookstores, you know, the shelves and tables piled with recently published books, bright covers, which are no longer possible because in his future, although there's some cause of optimism, nature is returning because industrial civilization is broken down, the supply lines, the supply chains are broken, and everything is rather local, and bookstores are rather drab. And so too is the intellectual environment.
You make a really interesting contrast at one point later in Tom's story, which follows on from that. So those are Tom's views of the time that we live in. But most of Tom's students seem to view us as living in a version of the last days of ancient Rome. I might not have thought that exactly before I read the book, but afterwards it did seem like a fair comment.
These students are mostly interested in the local fashions from the nearest power center, which is Nigeria. It's Nigeria that's kept the internet open. That internet is the means of access to the past for my researcher, Tom Metcalf. And yeah, so they're rather tired of hearing their elders groaning on about the past and what terrible things were happening and how many millions died and the local nuclear wars and the various catastrophes that happened throughout our century, the 21st century. And it rather reminds me, you know, of I grew up in the shadow of the Second World War, with 90 million, you know, estimates vary, but somewhere between 80 and 90 million people died, many of them civilians. And as we grew up and became teenagers and got our first jobs or went to university, we had rock and roll and paperback books and marijuana, and we got tired of hearing about the past. And I look back on those times with some embarrassment, really, because our parents' generation, especially the fathers, most of the fathers, had stood at the gates of hell and seen the most terrible things. My father was injured on the beaches of Dunkirk. He saw close friends, their heads blown off just 3 feet from where he stood. So I've given some of that kind of regret, embarrassment to future young people who are tired of hearing about our catastrophes and just want to get on in life and have fun and move into the present and into the future. And at one point, they even stage a walkout from a lecture. Don't want to hear any more about it.
I'm always interested when writers of fiction seek to imagine a future of one kind or another. How do you go about imagining the detail of the day-to-day life at Tom's point in the future? There's limitless possibilities in terms of ways that you can go. How do you get to that point in your head? Was that something that was scary to think about?
One thing you do is abandon prophecy. We don't know the future. I mean, we hardly know what's going to happen tomorrow. But you can draw straight lines from where we are now. And we seem to slide from one crisis to another. As for daily life, my assumption here was that if we don't have an all-out exchange of nuclear weapons, say between China and the USA, Russia joining in, we'll just about get through, we'll scrape through. We might do a lot of damage to our industrial civilization. The upside of that would be that nature could push back, biodiversity could perhaps get a chance. In my version, my speculation about the future, India and Pakistan go to war, and then so do Saudi Arabia joining with Israel in a war with Iran. Nuclear weapons are exchanged in both of those conflicts. It's not an all-out total global meltdown, but a lot of dust is put up in the air, as well as many millions die. That dust cools the earth by another 2 degrees, and we get just another chance to redeem ourselves in relation to climate change. So there's a kind of a thread of nuanced optimism here against all the hideous destruction. And so daily life, well, is rather timid. People are hanging on in there. Universities, humanities departments scraping by too. In Britain, since there's no industrial work going on, the main sources of metal is dredging up old cars from below the sea. Sea levels have risen 85 meters because of a huge nuclear weapon exploding mid-Atlantic. So Ireland, Britain, the west coast of Africa, the eastern seaboard of the United States, and Western Europe are deluged by a tsunami. So it's a very, very compromised world, but many things are also the same. People are always talking about, you know, the young today don't understand the past. The general sense, as I said earlier, is of a kind of intellectual timidity, highly conventional, worrying about what other people think intellectually about them. Yeah, very, 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 very samey. So my man, Tom Metcalf, would love to live in 2014 or 2025. And he runs a seminar called Literature 1990 to 2030, when literature was much bolder, much more willing to take risks. It's all speculation. I can't predict a thing, although I noticed, of course, that earlier this year, Pakistan and India did start sort of gazing down the barrels of their guns at each other. Mercifully, nothing went wrong there and everyone backed away. The main thing, though, when you speculate about the future in this way is you're thinking really of finding new ways to understand how we are now. And looking back from the point of view of 100 years, it's just one more place to stand. And I wanted to give Tom Metcalf a sense not only of the horrors, but of all that's precious to us now. And a great deal of biodiversity still exists. And there are many places in Ireland, as in Britain, where we'd love to hike and take the air and be glad to be alive. It's not all dark, and we still can turn it around. So that's the outer limits of my optimism.
I'm interested. Rose says to Tom at one point in the book that in its infancy, the derangement couldn't have been addressed by fictional realism, that it was inadequate to the scale of the problem. But that's at least partially what you're trying to do here, isn't it?
Yes, there's a very interesting conversation going on among writers about climate change. In fact, there are so many novels now that there's even a term for it. It's called cli-fi, which I learned in the process of writing this. Climate change is such an enormous issue. Masses of science, statistics, of course, there's oceanography, polar studies, statistics, et cetera, plus all the politics, plus all the private lives, plus immigration that will be massively affected by it. And then something that maybe is even more important than all that that surrounds us now, which is a metaphysical element, that we are possibly risking losing our belief in the future, believing in a sense of progress, of making things better for more people. And I think that's a very dangerous gateway to pass through, to abandon hope of making things better. And I hear it in people, not just intellectuals or teachers or culture critics or what have you, ordinary people saying that they don't think their children or grandchildren will have a better life than they did. And that's the metaphysical element that I was trying to address in this novel. In other words, to come back to those forking paths, if that notion that the future will be far worse than the present really takes hold, we will have got to the point where we would have abandoned hope and given up on the human project. And that would be, of course, very dangerous.
Ian McEwan, thank you so much for joining us on Arena.
My pleasure.
What We Can Know is published by Jonathan Cape.